I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. With the news of the death of Yordano Ventura, we'll begin with a look at the young pitcher's life and short career. Then the film critics will join us to review what's playing on area screens. They'll appraise Annette Bening's portrayal of a single mother and landlord who enlists her tenants for help in parenting her son. They'll let you know just how convincing Michael Keaton is in his role of the salesman behind a fast food empire, and how another Michael, Fassbender, fares as a member of a British clan of criminals. On this eve of the 89th Academy Award nomination announcements, we'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. We have our film critics in today and we're set to talk movies a day ahead of the announcements for this year's Oscar nominations. But we'd be remiss if we didn't take some time this morning talking about the sudden and shocking news of Royals pitcher Yordano Ventura's death. And we want to hear your thoughts. If you're a Royals fan, or even if you're not, how are you feeling today? What would you remember Yordano Ventura for? Give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Ventura died Saturday in his native Dominican Republic in a traffic accident. Fans all day yesterday traveled to Kauffman Stadium and laid down pennants, baseball caps, balloons, and flowers in a spontaneous memorial. We're now joined on the phone by KCUR sports reporter Greg Eklund. Greg, if you would, catch us up. Are there any updates about what we learned yesterday about Ventura's death? And again, he was killed in a traffic accident in the Dominican Republic.
Steve, we haven't really learned much more. It's interesting to note that, unfortunately, in the Americas, that the roads in the Dominican Republic are among the most dangerous roads as far as fatality rates. We don't know the circumstances on this one vehicle crash, but any way you look at it, it's so ironic that within hours of the passing of Yordano Ventura, that another former baseball player, Andy Marte, also had his life taken because of a vehicle crash in the Dominican Republic.
Right. Why do you think this is having such an impact, Greg? I mean, what did Yordano Ventura mean to the Royals? What did he mean to Kansas City?
Well, he meant a lot in the short time that he was with the Royals, and I think it meant so much more that to both the Royals and the fans that the Royals committed to him over the long haul with the contract that they awarded him at such a young age. They thought that this was a guy who was not only very good and very talented at the stage of his career when he reached the major leagues, but that there was so much more. And that's what probably saddens Royals fans and the Royals community, is that we never will have the chance to see the potential that Yordano Ventura was filled with. And in the moments that he was on top of his games, I mean, he was electrifying. Mm-hmm. Just when you look at the guy standing up barely 6 feet and around 185 pounds as he's listed, you wonder, how is a guy with that kind of build, how can he throw the ball like that? Because even his off-speed stuff was still close to 90 miles an hour, which was amazing.
I had the same thought so many times watching him pitch, Greg. You know, yesterday, General Manager Dayton Moore addressed the media, even as he was flying down to the Dominican Republic. What did he have to say?
Of course, very downtrodden, as you would expect, because of the fatalities that have claimed not only Yordano Ventura's life, but if you'll recall, during the World Series, Yordano was honoring one of his own countrymen, a close friend of his, Taveras, with the St. Louis organization, who also was fatally injured in the Dominican Republic during the 2015 World Series, if I'm not mistaken. But So this is something that's not just felt within the Royals and the Royals community, but throughout Major League Baseball.
Right.
And Dayton Moore was reflecting on how much reaction he was getting from those in the Major League Baseball community with sympathetic thoughts forwarded to him.
Again, we want your calls. Tell us what memories and thoughts you have about Yordano Ventura. You can give us a call, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. We also want to bring in Max Reaper. He's the editor of Royals Review. That's a popular Royals blog. Max, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
It was a brief career, obviously, but what is Yordano Ventura's place in Royals history, at least in your opinion?
Well, I think Greg kind of touched upon it. Like, it's difficult because he was struck down so young, and so we never got to see that kind of potential. And he was always a guy that had that electric stuff, but, we were kind of waiting for him to kind of put it all together. That being said, you know, at age 25, he'd already accomplished, I think, more than a lot of players do in their entire careers. He'd already pitched in two World Series. He'd won one. And I think what I'll remember is his Game 6 performance in the 2014 World Series,
right,
where the Royals had their backs up against the wall, had to win the game. And he was a rookie at that point. He'd only started less than 40 games in the major leagues. And he came out and just gave them a great performance, 7 shutout innings. They defeated the Giants 10-0. That forced a Game 7. And I think if the Royals had been victorious in that Game 7, that might be considered one of the best postseason performances in recent baseball history. So, I think his place in Royals history is of unrecognized potential, but also of a player that did accomplish quite a bit in the short time that we only got to see.
You know, the Royals Annual Fan Fest is scheduled for this weekend at Bartle Hall. That normally is a celebratory event. You know, fans get to interact with players and get excited for the upcoming season. It's hard to think that Ventura's death isn't going to have a major impact on that event this weekend, Max.
Yeah, I think it'll definitely be a more somber affair, but I think it also comes at a good time where it'll allow fans and the Royals organization to kind of come together and commiserate and help them through the grieving process. I mean, Christian Colon, Royals infielder, was at the vigil last night that fans set up at Kauffman Stadium, and he said that we'll get through this together. And I don't think he meant the Royals team. I think he meant all the Royals fans, the Royals organization, and the entire community. And that's kind of what this Royals team has meant to this city of Kansas City and the Royals fans. I think they've become a family, and this will be kind of like a family coming together at Fan Fest this weekend at Bartle Hall and remembering Yordano Ventura and kind of offering condolences. And I think this will be a good way for Royals fans to get over that pain a little bit and remember a player who was very popular, I think, with a lot of fans.
Ultimately, Max, you remember Yordano Ventura for what?
I think I'll remember that electric fastball, but I also remember that he was an emotional player, for better or for worse, that loved playing the game of baseball and just always had a smile on his face in that clubhouse. I mean, what I remember is when they clinched the 2015 World Series, how enthusiastic he was, saying they were going back to the World Series. And so, he's a guy, I think baseball needs more players like Yordano Ventura. And you took the good with the bad. You know, he certainly had dust-ups with other teams, but you look at the outpouring of support he had from around the league and from his teammates who saw him as like a brother. And, that's what I'll remember, as an emotional guy who had an electric fastball and was just taken away from us far too soon.
That's Max Reaper of Royals Review. Max, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go back to KCUR's Greg Eklund, who's still on the line. Greg, you talked to a fan yesterday. His name is Andrew Keach, who had come out to Kauffman Stadium. This is what Andrew Keach had to say.
Didn't know what else to do. That's hurts a lot for sure. He was a hothead, but everything he did was for his team. And you could tell he loved what he was doing. And he cared about everything he did, for sure. And it just sucks because, every time you thought about Yordano, you thought what he could be, And I feel like if, just another 5 years, he could have definitely been one of the best pitchers in baseball. And it hurts for the whole team, I'm sure. Can't even imagine.
You said you didn't know what else to do, but obviously you care about this team and you care about its players so much that you came out here to Kauffman Stadium.
For sure. for sure. I mean, this everybody who's been on this team the last few years, you're gonna remember every single one of them. I mean, even when Dyson got traded, that hit everybody pretty hard. Something like this, you know, it goes beyond baseball.
You know, Greg, that's a sentiment we're hearing a lot right now, that this team and these players mean more than just baseball to a lot of fans in Kansas City.
Justifiably so. They provided the city with memories for a generation. They had not won a division or a world championship since 1985, so a generation later, we saw it in the turnout for the parade that the Royals had that included Jordano Ventura, because he was very much a valuable member of the 2014 and 2015 World Series teams, and that the fans in turn showed their love, not only with the parade, but by their turnout at Kauffman Stadium yesterday.
Greg, what were you expecting out of Ventura this season? What was the expectation for a pitcher maybe entering his prime years of his career?
I had high expectations this season because I know he did not feel good about last season. He knew that he had some great moments last season, but he knew from start to finish that he had yet to put together the solid from start to finish season that he was looking for. And I think with Danny Duffy signing the extension this winter and anchoring himself with the Royals pitching staff, I'm of the thinking that Jordano was very much in tune to contributing from his role as a frontline starter to help the Royals get back to the postseason, which is where they feel they should be.
That's KCUR's Greg Eklund speaking with us today, a day after this city learned of the untimely passing of Royals pitcher Jordano Ventura, dead at age 25. Greg, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Okay, even though it's only Monday, we're going to talk movies with our film critics today about the latest independent movies now showing. But we have another motive, which is that on Tuesday, tomorrow, Oscar nominations will be announced, and that's how we're going to begin our show today. But first, let me once again introduce our critics to you. They are Cindy Haynes, the one-time film professor. Cindy, always good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR's Steve Walker sits to my left. Steven,
thank you.
Good morning.
I do. Yeah.
Bob Butler rounds out the panel. He's a film critic for the Kansas City Star, and you can read his reviews at butlerscinemascene.com. Robert, how
good
are
morning.
You?
Good morning. Great.
Well, let's talk about the Oscar nominations. They're coming out tomorrow. It's always a big moment, a big day in the movie industry. Early predictions, Cindy, for the big awards, Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress. Are these things already locked up, or is there some sense of drama as we go into this thing?
Well, pretty much. I just want to preface my comments. I think there are too many award shows, and I think it's ludicrous that the same six movies are being nominated for the Critics' Choice Awards, for the Golden Globes, and now the Oscars.
Why is that? Why though?
Well, the main reason is because of a lot of the people who are members of the Academy are working professionals. So they don't have the time like Bob and Steve and I and you have to watch movies. And so when they're inundated with 100 DVD screeners, they'll say, well, let's see, La La Land's been nominated and won. I think I ought to watch that one. Fences has been nominated. I think I ought to watch it. So they're just watching the same six movies that other people have said are the best of the year, and they're what, over 300 movies are produced over the course of 12 months?
So it's just a circle, people running after each other, chasing the same films, it sounds like.
It gets narrowed down by that kind of buzz and that kind of inside dirt and scoop, and just as we were discussing movies before the show, what we'd seen lately, and some of these today, we're talking about the very things that all come at once. They all come right at this time of year.
Which is a shame.
The interesting thing about the Oscars, of course, is that unlike the Golden Globes, which has actors and performances in both dramatic and musical
comedy,
slash comedy,
you
only get five with the Oscars. There's, you know, you're going to have to decide, narrow it down for us. And that's always kind of a heartbreaker.
Except picture could be between 5 and 10.
That's right.
Tomorrow that, when those
because
are announced.
About 5 years ago, the Oscars said we could have as many as 10 Best Picture nominees.
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of nice because it's going to bring up a few movies that are off the radar.
Sure. Including animated films, too.
Possibly, yeah.
So what determines, though, Steve, if there are 5 nominees for Best Picture versus 10? What's how do we know?
Oh, my God. It's like the most complicated.
Archaic.
You have to have a computer with a special algorithm for crying out loud to figure this out.
It's very, very complicated. Depending on what order they come in and what, you know, ranking, some groups rank and some don't, and it's just very
confusing.
Well,
isn't there some bias built in? I would just assume for commercial reasons, to get more people in the seats, that you'd want to nominate 10 films as opposed to 5.
That's part of it, too. Yeah, I think the filmmakers in the studios were saying, wait a minute, why is this what is this arbitrary 5? But they've stuck to the 5 for every other category.
Okay. Well, as of this moment, is there a runaway frontrunner for Best Picture?
La La Land.
Manchester by the Sea.
My pick would be Manchester by the Sea.
Runaway, Manchester by the Sea. Great movie. I think it's too dark for the Oscar folks. I think they will give the...
Oh, unlike the Hurt Locker.
But after...
Just remind us what Manchester by the Sea is.
It's a story of a middle-aged guy whose brother dies. He finds himself now the guardian of his... teenage nephew, and he is not up to the task.
Right. It's about grief.
He's got his own grief issues from his marriage. So, yeah.
And Casey Affleck does an amazing job as the lead actor in this film.
And La La Land, the other film that you've mentioned for Best Picture, what's that about?
I watched it again. It's a musical. It's a love letter to Los Angeles and dreams and making it in Hollywood, that sort of thing. And I reassessed the film after I saw it again, and I thought, it really isn't that great a musical.
It's not. And Saturday Night Live did a skit Saturday about... people who were afraid to say they didn't like La La Land that much.
No. You know, the interesting thing here is I think it's going to win because of momentum and because it last time, whenever Oscar gets a halfway decent musical, Chicago, something like that, they jump on the bandwagon because it reminds them of how things used to be.
Right.
And this movie even goes back and recreates MGM type fantasy ballet sequences, so it taps into this yearning for the good old days of musicals.
So is this a fight for Best Picture between Manchester by the Sea and La La Land?
I would throw Moonlight in there as well. If any the lowest
budget
movie
to
ever win.
If there's
a
spoiler,
it
could be
it. Won the Golden Globe for Best
drama.
And Moonlight was about what, Steve?
About the first 20 years of a gay black man's life. In 3 chapters. One is a child in elementary school, one is a high school student, and one is a young adult.
And the actors in that film
are
beautiful.
Incredible. It's just a beautifully shot.
They really are very
talented. I've
heard
nothing but good things about that film. Yeah. So what other films might be in the running for Best Picture?
Fences, that's true. Yep.
The Denzel Washington remake of an August Wilson play.
Yes, and he was out, and Octavia Spencer were brilliant in this film. But there's
Davis.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
but that it's a play. It's a filmed play. So, you know, to what extent does that? I don't want to say disqualify it from being considered. Many, many great movies started out as plays.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf comes to mind.
So, that might work against it with some people.
Okay, and other films that might be in the running?
Well, Bob and I were talking before the show. Isabelle Huppert gives the most commanding female performance, if not performance, of the year in Elle, which is...
Just opened.
It won the Globe for her, for Best Actress.
We'll be doing that in just a few minutes.
Yeah. But it's for France did not let it move forward as contender for Best Foreign Language Film. Hmm. And they get to decide.
Yeah. And Paul Verhoeven directed. Well, we'll talk about
it. Yeah, we will.
Okay. How about Best Actor? Is there any drama with this thing, or is Casey Affleck, who starred in Manchester by the Sea, going to win this thing?
Casey Affleck or Denzel Washington. And I think, given the two, I would give it to Denzel.
Oh, I would give it to Casey.
And Bob, break the tie, please.
Wow, tricky. I find myself absolutely deadlocked on this one because they're two very different kinds of performances. One is Shakespearean and the other is very internalized.
Yes.
And they both work beautifully
at
what they're supposed to do.
Okay, so Casey Affleck versus Denzel Washington for Best Actor, Best Actress.
Well, you got to think of Isabel. Now,
Yeah.
But for La La Land, Emma Stone is kind of riding a wave right now.
She's good. She's fine.
I'm hearing a lot about Annette Bening's performance as well.
We will talk about
that. It's a terrific performance.
Yeah. We will talk about that. Yeah, absolutely.
And her film is what?
20th Century Women.
20th Century Women, right.
Which,
okay.
Talk about a weekend on which to discuss the movie, right?
But okay. So that's your primer on the Oscar nominations coming out tomorrow. You've got our critics' picks already. We'll see how they prove to be here. Okay.
Or suggestions.
Or
Let's
suggestions. Okay.
Yes.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here, and we're going to run through a whole series of films that are now showing to give our listeners a sense of what might be worth their time in the days ahead here for a good film. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. We've got some good shows lined up for this week. On Wednesday, we'll learn about Langston Hughes' childhood over in Lawrence. And on Friday, we'll hear how a KU professor is using sci-fi films to promote science education. Yes, folks, it's happening. That's this week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, today we're talking about films and the latest and best independent films now showing. We're doing this show one day before the Oscar nominations come out. That'll happen on Tuesday. Our critics, once again, Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, Bob Butler. Let's go to a film I mentioned right before the break, 20th Century Women. It's a vehicle for Annette Bening, who's getting all kinds of kudos for her performance here during the summer of 1979 in Santa Barbara. A single mom and boarding house landlord decides the best way to parent her teenage son is to enlist the help of her tenants. And I have a little empathy for that kind of thinking, given my household these days, Bob.
It's made by Mike Mills. I'm sorry that he only had two parents to make movies about.
Oh, I know.
His last movie was 2001's Beginners, and it starred Christopher Plummer as Mike Mills' father, who at age 74 announced that, A, I'm dying of cancer, and B, I'm gay.
Plummer won an Oscar for that role.
A nomination.
No, he won.
Did he win?
Yep.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yep. Okay, yep. So now Mike Mills comes back. He's making a movie about his mother. Mike Mills was a 15-year-old kid growing up, I believe it's Oakland, in his mother's sprawling, collapsing mansion, which is full of tenants that she has rented it out to. You've got Greta Gerwig as a redheaded, photographer? Photographer.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got Billy Crudup as the handyman.
Like,
well,
yeah.
I was going to say the priapic handyman, you know. And you've got Elle Fanning, who is absolutely ethereal as the 17-year-old high school girl who nightly climbs the scaffolding around the house, enters the 15-year-old's bedroom, and sleeps with him, not for sex, because she has plenty of boys that want to do that, but because she wants to get away from the rest of her life. Mm. You can imagine how this plays with a 15-year-old boy. The great thing about this is you've got, in one of her best performances, and that's saying something, Annette Bening plays the mom, a chain-smoking feminist that's set in the mid-70s, who basically takes all these women, plus her handyman William, and recruits them to raise her son. It's sort of a takes-a-village kind of idea. What kid wants to listen to his mommy? No kid. But if other people, you know,
offer suggestions.
Pretty soon he's reading Betty Friedan. So it's really a funny, and I found to be extremely touching in the long haul, film about growing up at a specific time with a socio-political thing swirling
so
around.
So a big
there.
Thumbs up from
oh,
you
big
for
thumbs up from
20th
me.
Century Women, Cindy.
I want to make the point that it is so refreshing to see a talented actress like Bening, who's 58 years old, not have fish lips and facial surgery to try to stay young. She looked like an adult woman, and it was so nice to see that. Also, the box office take this past weekend, all of that is being sent to Planned Parenthood.
Mm.
They're big supporters. She
obviously is married to Warren Beatty.
Right.
Isn't there? She's Hollywood royalty, isn't she?
She is.
Do I have that sense?
You know,
right?
I mean, many years ago on this program, her performance in The Kids Are All Right, I talked on the air about this is a masterclass in acting. Is to watch her. And I don't think this performance is that, but I think it's just terrific. And she's so funny. Her character's very eccentric. The school says, your kid's missing a lot of school. And she's like, so? Mm-hmm. He's got other things to do. He's reading. Mm-hmm. You know, she's that kind of woman.
I think she made that character uniquely hers. I can't quite imagine another actress playing that part and doing such a good job.
Okay. That film, 20th Century Women, if I'm hearing correctly, three thumbs
yes,
up.
Yes, it's on my three to see.
For 20th Century Women. Terrific. Okay. Let's go to Trespass Against Us, Steve Walker. This is a film about three generations of a British clan of criminals battling the police and each other.
Right. And so it starts, and you've got Brendan Gleeson as the patriarch of this crime
Old
family.
Old Testament style.
Michael Fassbender as his son, and then he's got an 8-year-old son who can't help but absorb some of this psychopathology. They live in a circle of trailers with animal carcasses hanging around. And
like gypsies.
Goats.
They are gypsies. Wow. They're travelers.
And they have a very antagonistic relationship, but they goad it with the local police. And so all the DNA is here for a terrific film. The problem is the Irish brogues, nothing against Irish people or brogues, is so thick. Mm. At least half of the movie, I didn't understand a word they were saying.
Same here.
Ouch.
It was really wished for subtitles.
Subtitles. Sometimes British films even, you go, okay, I'm not... takes a minute to get into it, but this one is just... New York Times said the same thing. It needed subtitles.
I'm a big fan of Michael Fassbender.
Oh, they're both great actors.
I think he is fantastic in the film.
Yeah.
There's another film, Animal Kingdom.
Sure.
About
the Australian.
A film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was a bit more powerful, a better film.
Well, this is basically an escape story. The Fassbender character has to decide if he's going to be able to escape his father's tentacles, criminal tentacles, and get his family out from under him.
Right. He's like the King Lear of the trailer court.
And the way
he
finds to do that is, a surprise.
Hmm. So, I can't recommend it.
If you can't understand what's being said, that's a pretty big demerit here.
So, consequently, we don't have a clip because...
wouldn't have mattered.
And the few words you would recognize, you can't put on the air.
You can't say on the air, right.
So, a non-recommendation for the film, Trespass Against
Us. Like I said, the DNA was all there. It's just...
Never came together.
It was too hard to follow.
Yeah. Okay, let's scoot ahead then to a film that maybe might be a little more understandable. It's The film is titled The Founder. I just saw it this weekend. This is Michael Keaton starring as Ray Kroc, a milkshake machine salesman who displaces hamburger entrepreneurs, the McDonald's brothers, to create a very famous fast food empire, Cindy.
It's an interesting film.
It is.
Michael Keaton does a wonderful job
Terrific.
As playing Kroc. My issue with the film was, is this an unethical, obsessed businessman? Or do we really have sympathy for the McDonald brothers?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's not obvious. It's
I thought it was pretty obvious. I think when this film ends, you walk out the door thinking not so highly of Ray Kroc.
Right. Well, I wish the assault on him would have been a bit stronger, more powerful.
That's interesting.
Considering what he did. I mean, he basically took this business over. Nick Offerman plays Nick McDonald and John Carroll Lynch, two really good actors who are totally lost in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been anyone playing those parts, and I wish that had been a little stronger. Keaton has this thing about twisting his neck or his head quickly to the left or to the right as if he's going to tell you a secret. And I kept seeing these same ticks in him. I know you love the movie, Steve, and I'm just kind of... offering the negative aspects of my reaction to the film. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting story. A lot of people think Ray Kroc, you know, was the genius behind it. And he was, but...
He was the genius in franchising it. He talked to the McDonald brothers, very humble men, very proud men, small business owners, which is the backbone of America, right? I'm not running for anything. He talked them into, with their arms pinned behind their backs, to franchise it. He talked them into bringing Coke in, and they were saying, that's mass commercialism. That is not us.
Mm-hmm.
We are not those people. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up shaking his hand, not keeping his word, and screwed them out of billions of dollars, if you add it up over the years.
Absolutely.
The McDonald's grandson was on CBS Sunday Morning yesterday.
What did he have to say?
He said he talked about, they said, do you ever think about the $100 billion a year that your family got screwed out of? And he said, no, it's my grandpa never thought about it. It's not going to happen. So, you know, move on.
This is the McDonald side.
Grandson. The McDonald's grandson. Okay, yeah, right. Nobody from the Kroc family talked to the CBS Sunday morning.
Oh, that's really interesting.
But he, like you said earlier, Steve, before the show, he comes off as a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mean, vindictive man.
But it's tempered. It's tempered. I wish
it's
that
tempered
would've
because
been...
it's Michael Keaton, you know.
Well, that's a star can sell a villain in ways.
He was
that,
less crazy in Birdman because it was Michael Keaton. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's his time. Spotlight last year, Birdman.
He's great in Spotlight. I really enjoyed it. I really did.
It was just a really good, solid film. This is not, you know, a spectacular, greatest film in the history of Hollywood, but I just thought it was just a very good, solid film.
And it's very interesting.
Very interesting. It kept me watching and interested the whole way through, which is a trick these days.
Yeah, me too.
For somebody
I
like me. We have a clip here from the founders.
Yes, this is what Ray Kroc envisions for his company, McDonald's.
Driving around, I just cannot stop thinking about this tremendous restaurant. Now, at the risk of sounding blasphemous, forgive me. Those arches have a lot in common with those buildings. A building, well, a cross on top, what is that? It's a gathering place where decent, wholesome people come together and they share values protected by that American flag. It could be said that that beautiful building flanked by those arches signifies more or less the same thing. It doesn't just say delicious hamburgers inside. They signify family. It signifies community. It's a place where Americans come together to break bread. I am telling you, McDonald's can be the new American church, feeding bodies and feeding souls, and it ain't just open on Sundays, boys.
His vision was fascinating. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, like with all Hollywood films, I sort of walked away thinking, well, how much of this film is true? What's been embellished?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I have the answer to that.
Yeah, there were three wives, no reference whatsoever to the second wife.
No. Laura Dern has a thankless role as his first wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That film, The Founder, two thumbs up from our... Am I hearing that right? Two thumbs up from and Cindy here. Okay. Let's move on to L. Steve Walker. This is a controversial drama about a rape victim who responds to her attacker in unexpected ways.
It is controversial, and it's powerful, and it's a lot. There's a lot going on in this. In the first 3 minutes of the film, the great French... She's the French Meryl Streep. Let's not...
Or Meryl Streep is the French.
That's true.
Isabel.
Right.
Isabel Huppert is raped, and it's tough to watch. And following it, she sweeps up the broken glass, takes a bath, and orders hamachi. Later in the film, she shares with her friends at dinner. They're about to order wine, and she tells them that she was assaulted. And they said, are you okay? Are you going to report it? And she goes, it's over.
Hmm.
So you guys start to get clues that this woman is sort of damaged, sort of has an interesting, complicated view of sex and sexuality and rape, because she becomes sort of obsessed with the man who raped her. And I don't want to give away too much because we learn who that was, not at the very last 5 minutes, but...
Yeah.
With 45 minutes left to go, Bob, how can we explain this?
Well, it's not a traditional rape revenge, you know, scenario.
No, no, no.
Although in a way it is. So we see how complicated it gets.
Right.
What I found fascinating about this is that the character she has created is a person so convinced of her own superiority to the rest of the world that she views the rest of humanity with something that's not quite contempt. The fact is she's got enough sense of humor and enough innate charm that she's able to skirt the darker sides of her personality and actually be someone you could think, this person might be fun to hang out with. I mean, she's got a wicked tongue. She's she sees through BS like nobody's business.
She's also an executive of a company that makes video games.
Violent.
There's a scene where she's giving her animators a pep talk, and she says, "When he guts the orc, I want the player to feel blood on his hands." And mm-hmm. this is a woman who's just been assaulted.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on.
And there's a trauma in her younger life that explains her reticence about the cops.
Although
too.
I will have to say that I found that digression mm-hmm. to be one too many issues piled on a pretty interesting
that's
character.
Fair. Yeah. That's fair.
It was directed by Paul Verhoeven, who did Basic Instinct. He initially wanted to make it in America. He went through every A-list actress in
Nobody
Hollywood, and no one would touch the film. Mm. Hubert read the script, loved it, said she would only make it in France. Mm. And I think she does an extraordinary job. I can't imagine anyone else playing that part.
I can't imagine a director whose resume includes both Showgirls and Elle.
Right, right.
Well, are you recommending this film?
I loved it.
But Be Forewarned, it's very
tough.
Violent and disturbing.
We see the rape several times, a couple times from just different angles, but a third time in her head, the revenge fantasy starts to unfold. Hmm. And then once she kind of connects with this man, there's other horrible things happen, her performance is amazing.
Well, let's put it this way. Traditional feminists are likely to stand aghast at this because it kind of goes against all of the inbred ideas. I mean, this person is twisted, but she's fun to watch.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That film is titled Elle. It's controversial. It's violent, but apparently it's a pretty good film, at least based on what our critics are saying. And if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the latest independent films now showing. Earlier this hour, we talked about Oscar nominations coming out tomorrow. Got some interesting predictions from our critics about who they think will be up and nominated. You can listen to that on replay after our show is over today. Okay, let's move on here to a film, Bob Butler. This film is titled Silence. It's about two 17th century Jesuit priests from Portugal traveling to Japan to locate their mentor despite the continued slaughter of Christians by Japanese authorities.
This is Martin Scorsese's dream project of the last 20 years. He fell in love with the novel, which was published in Japan, written by a Japanese Christian some 40 years ago. It's a movie that is absolutely beautiful to watch, and yet I did not find the emotional payoff I wanted. The Japanese authorities are pretty much doing what the Spanish Inquisition was doing, torturing anybody who varies from the party line. Christianity was seen as a huge threat. So you have these two priests hiding in Japan, being sought by the authorities, trying to tend to their flock of converts, many of whom find themselves dying horribly at the hands of the police, as it were, for keeping their faith. The ultimate nub of this movie is this. The Japanese inquisitor, a very talky guy who reminds me of the old American actor William Hickey, he will not torture the priest played by Andrew Garfield. Instead, he will torture and kill Garfield's followers, the Christian members of his flock, until he recants. So the ultimate question is, it's one thing to sacrifice yourself for your beliefs. Can you sacrifice other people? That's an interesting, tough question. What I found, though, is that the film, with a running time of nearly 3 hours, does not need all that. Mm-mm. It's a question that could have been posed and answered in, an hour 40 minutes. And I found myself wishing for a good old samurai sword fight with Toshiro Mifune before it was all over.
You kind of expect that in a few scenes, too.
You do. Because it's very quiet, and despite the execution scenes and all, it's not an overtly violent movie in the way most Japanese, movies are.
There's a lot of torture and a lot of violence.
A lot, yes. And you forgot to say, too, that they go to look for Liam Neeson's character, who they hear. He's been the priest there that's been working there for a while. They hear that he's given up his faith. He's turned his back on his faith. And so that's what gets them to Japan in the first place. I couldn't tell if it was an indictment of religion or an embrace of religion. And as a friend of mine said, after I told him that, he goes, well, that's Scorsese's thing. He's always been the master of ambivalence.
Well,
right? The Catholic Church has always been a factor in his films. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can find it from Raging Bull to,
Mean Streets, holding your hand over a candle flame to see if you can stand it when you die.
Mm-hmm. But Scorsese, this has been an obsession. Scorsese's now 74 years old. This is for 30 years he's been trying to get this made. He was way too close to it. You're right, Bob. It could have been shortened significantly. Scorsese did The Last Temptation of Christ, mm-hmm. which is also...
And Kundun, about the childhood of the Dalai Lama.
Right. So he can't get this out of his system. Mm-mm. He had trouble getting it financed. He had trouble getting it made. And one of the reasons we don't hear much about it is number one, the fact that it is so incredibly violent. I mean, it's just one scene of torture after another. But it's just, it was released late in the season. We never had an opportunity to see it at a screening or anything. And it was touted before anybody saw it as Scorsese's masterpiece, but other eyes should have looked at it and he should have listened.
Why doesn't that happen?
Well, he's our greatest living filmmaker.
Well, okay, I get that. But who's beyond editing, Bob Butler? I mean, I don't think are. And I certainly am not after 35 years
as
a journalist.
No, that's absolutely true.
You know?
And he has one of the best editors in the business,
Thelma Shoemaker. Yeah. Well, no, it is great. It isn't the editing per se. It's the overall concept is dragged out, and it doesn't need to be.
For example, real quick, there's a scene where they torture these men by hanging them on crosses and putting them in the surf of the ocean.
In a tidal pool that rises.
And then it rises, and then, you know, as water does, it recedes, and then it rises again and comes up to their eyes, and he does this three times. We watch the rise and fall. Did we need that? It doesn't need to be. It needs to be an hour shorter.
Okay. So I'm getting thumbs down.
I'm glad I saw it.
Glad you
saw
it. I am too.
Yeah. What can I say?
Because it's Scorsese, some of his great...
And there's some visually there's some amazing stuff here.
Visionary.
And we should mention Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver as the two young priests. Yeah. And Liam Neeson has a very small part
that
appears at the end of the film.
Okay, but you're glad you saw it because it's Scorsese.
Yes.
Yep.
But again,
yes.
But in terms of great entertainment, I'm not hearing.
If you care about the movies, Scorsese's body of work is something you must embrace.
On a big screen.
Even if you're not, individually with every film knocked out.
And if you're suffering from a crisis of faith and are searching for redemption, this is the film to see.
That film, again, is titled Silence, in case you're wondering about it. That's Martin Scorsese's latest film, maybe his masterpiece, maybe not. Okay.
Yeah, maybe not.
Let's move on to another film I saw and enjoyed very much. Again, I'm a simple man with simple taste. It's so interesting. Hidden Figures, Cindy. It's three African-American women make significant contributions to NASA's early space program back in the 1960s based on actual events and some terrific performances, including one by Janelle Monáe here from Kansas City. So, yeah.
A lot of people who saw the script initially said, why hasn't this story been told until now? I think it is an incredibly entertaining glimpse at an important role that African-American women played in American history. I found it very entertaining at times. I think it bordered on cartoonish, this issue of segregated bathrooms and workspaces and whatever. But the three actresses who played these three women, I think, did a wonderful job showing three different personalities. This has been doing extremely well at the box office. So,
which floors me in some ways.
It's made $84 million as of this weekend.
You know, it's a feel-good movie.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that racism is an element in it, it's about triumph. And it's about being an American.
And being seen.
It's about coming together and getting something done. I mean, that's a hard message to put down.
Two of the women who were portrayed, and I just want to speak their names, Dorothy Vaughn and Mary Jackson. They have died, but Katherine Johnson is still alive at the age of 98. And the actresses were thrilled that she was still around to see this movie made.
These weren't just... African-American women. These were people who were so mathematically brilliant that their actual job description was computer.
They compute figures,
This was before. This is when an IBM computer took an entire floor of an office building.
Mm-hmm.
These women sat around and worked numbers for NASA and It's astounding.
Yeah,
they were savants in when it came to math, I guess.
Well, I liken this film to The Founder, the Michael Keaton film about Ray Kroc, only in the sense that you take a slice of history that's largely unknown, and you just do a good, solid movie around it. Not a lot of sex, not a lot of violence, but just a great film and very solid. And I enjoyed both of them just tremendously, just terrific. What's the clip we have here from Hidden Figures, Cindy?
Yes, some interesting comments coming from the character played by Octavia.
There is another opening in the engineer training program. A person with engineer's mind should be an engineer. You can't be a computer the rest of your life.
Mr. Zelinsky, I'm a Negro woman. I'm not going to entertain the impossible.
And I'm a Polish Jew whose parents died in a Nazi prison camp. Now I'm standing beneath a spaceship that's going to carry an astronaut to the stars. Let me ask you, if you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
That's Janelle Monáe.
That's Schlegel High School graduate, Janelle Monáe.
My mistake.
Yeah, from right here in our backyard. Again, that film, Hidden Figures, lots of thumbs up, lots of popular reviews, favorable reviews around the country. People going to see that film, which is interesting to me. I just had no idea that people would be drawn to something like that.
And this is also Janelle's year. She's in the movie Moonlight also.
So conceivably she could be in. With her first two movie roles, she might be in Best Picture nominees.
Right?
That's true. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Let's scoot over to a film, a little controversial, Jackie, about Jacqueline Kennedy. This is an unorthodox, stylized recounting of the week back in 1963 when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It stars Natalie Portman, City.
She does an amazing job. There is an opening scene where she's facing the camera, and the first sentence or two she says blew my mind because she sounded exactly like Jackie Kennedy. Now, her accent has been described as a combination of a whole variety of different East Coast accents, but she pulls off the Jackie character so well. I'm of a generation that sat in front of the TV set the whole funeral, who watched Jackie Kennedy with the tour of the White House. I mean, I knew all of that, and it was a very powerful time in my life and in American history. But to see her resurrected in this way, I thought was very exciting.
You talked about slice of history earlier. Mm-hmm. What we get to see in this film are some things I didn't know, is that she took a very, very forceful stand about what that funeral would look like.
Mm-hmm.
There was all this concern about
safety.
Nobody wants to walk down the street. And
yeah,
she said, I don't care. I understand it. I'm walking with my husband. And yeah. I agree with Cynthia. Portman's performance is terrific. And
Peter Sarsgaard is in there as Robert Kennedy, and I think that was a misstep.
That was a goof. Yeah.
Yeah. It really.
How difficult is it watching the recreation of the assassination?
Well, it gets graphic. It's repeated several times, and it gets more graphic each time.
It's more graphic than the Zapruder film because it's shot from different angles. As you said, it's very stylized.
Mm-hmm.
There's an overhead shot that was
yeah.
of the car going down the street that was just almost mixed beauty and horror in one and image.
Lest we remind people, they said, Mrs. Kennedy, we have a new dress for you to wear as they're flying back to D.C.
Oh,
and she
no.
goes,
yeah.
uh-uh. Let they're going to see what they've done. Done.
Yeah,
right?
It's the famous line. Yeah.
Portman,
yeah.
It should be seen for Portman's fantastic performance, which won the Kansas City Film Critics Circle's Award for Best Actress.
I tell you, one of the most riveting interviews, at least in my estimation, that we've had on this program during the 15 years I've been here is with Clint Hill, who was the Secret Service agent who jumped on the back of Kennedy's car.
I remember that interview.
And he remembers the details of that day with riveting precision. Mm-hmm. And I was haunted almost by that conversation for a long time afterward, given the trajectory of his life and what he went through, having had to endure the days of that assassination. We have a clip here from
Jackie. Hear her take on Jackie's voice. She's talking to Billy Crudup, who plays a writer who interviewed her.
Sort of a William Manchester type.
A month after the assassination.
This is from Jackie.
You'll have to share something personal eventually. People won't stop asking until you do.
And if I don't, they'll interpret my silence however they want. Her brow furrows, her lips are drawn. She holds back her tears, but she can't hide her anger.
Most writers want to be famous.
You want to be famous?
No, I am fine as I am, thank you.
You should prepare yourself. This article will bring you a great deal of attention.
Oh, in that case, any advice for me?
Yes. Don't marry the president.
Whoa. Poof. I got goosebumps listening to that. It was just...
It's something else.
Yeah.
That's from Jackie Natalie Portman. She'll be up for an Oscar for Best Actress. Absolutely. Any question about that? Yeah. Okay.
For what it's worth, Jackie was 35 years old when all this happened. Mm-hmm. Natalie 35. Portman is 35.
Mm.
Wow.
She was a kid.
Okay. We have time just for one final film. The title of this film, Steve Walker, is Lion. It's about set in the late 1980s in central India. While on a train, a five-year-old boy becomes separated from his older brother. He winds up thousands of miles away, is eventually placed in an orphanage and adopted by a couple from Australia, and there's a plot for you.
Well, and that's the movie. The first half is him as 6 years old, lost in this train station. Much better half of the movie.
It's like a Dickens story.
The second half, where he's played by Dev Patel, who's going to college, has a girlfriend, and kind of, understandably missing some connection to his family.
25 years later, though, and there's nothing in between. It takes you from that fabulous first
half. It's basically a two-hour commercial for Google Earth.
That's how he locates the family he left.
The first hour was riveting. The second hour, I was whatever.
What, disappointed?
Yeah, disappointing.
I didn't think it was terrible, but it didn't grab me like that first hour did. You got a little boy lost in the Indian subcontinent. Yeah. And he's escaping, child molesting kidnappers and living off the streets and sleeping with other little children in the subway. Right. And it's,
But stick around for the credits because you get to see the real people who are portrayed in this film.
The credits are very moving.
But mixed reviews here for Lion.
I gave it quite a strong thumbs up. It's a good movie for me.
Thumb sideways.
Is there one thing, Cindy, coming up in the weeks to come that movie goers ought to be really interested in?
I'll tell you one that's coming up hopefully next week. Patterson, the new Jim Jarmusch movie, which I absolutely loved. It's a poetic movie about just silly plain folks.
Oscar shorts are going to be showing at the Tivoli February 10th through the 24th.
And Pedro Almodovar's new movie, Julieta, which I loved.
Okay.
It opens in 2 weeks.
We'd like you to know about a special screening of The Thing this Friday at 6:30 on the Edwards campus of KU as part of its Sci-Flix series. We have the professor behind the series that looks at the research, science, and public policy depicted in films on the program this coming Friday morning. But that's at 6:30. Friday evening on the Edwards campus. Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler, thank you all very much. Yep. Appreciate it. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.